The following presentation was recorded at the 1998 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
And to entertain the subject of teaching math, Father, we just recognize here right to begin with that everything that we will talk about today had been created in your mind. It came forth from the deepness and the strength of your creativity many, many, many years ago. And we are only now discovering, perhaps just the tip of the iceberg of what you have done. And so I pray that as we think about teaching math, that you would give us wisdom and understanding and a profitable time together this afternoon. Give us efficiency of our time in energy. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, the discussion before us this afternoon is teaching math. And I would like to keep the focus right there. I'm not sure how many of you may be first-year teachers or anticipating your first year or second or third or fourth. I intend to be fairly elementary with this discussion. Hopefully it will be helpful to you. So we want to talk about some general things to begin with, and then we want to take two lessons right straight out of a textbook and talk about how a person might go about teaching that lesson. And if there is time remaining, then we will take questions and answers. We'll take questions from you and hopefully answers as well. So we'll see how it goes. I'd like to have our thoughts surround three different words today when it comes to teaching math. The words concepts or concept, computation, and application. In almost any achievement test that is given, you will find these three categories listed as the categories that the student ought to be tested in. In fact, I'm going to borrow from one of those tests this afternoon, just to talk about these three things. As a teacher, when you're teaching mathematics, you're going to teach concepts, you're going to teach them how to compute, and you're going to hopefully teach them how to solve problems. Why is mathematics very often at least a class that at least a student will tolerate, if not like? Well, because there's a pretty clear connection between mathematics and problem solving. They're pretty sure by the time they're 10 years old that they're going to have to know a certain amount of math just to keep their checkbook straight. As well as whatever other problems they may be facing. So your job is to teach these three. And what we want to do today, here to begin with, is talk about what is involved in concepts and computation and application. And then we want to go and just take a lesson or so and walk through it and show how you would make sure that in every lesson or in close to every lesson, you would be talking about concepts, maybe not in a direct manner, but at least indirectly. The students are picking up on some concepts. Secondly, you're going to teach them how to compute. And third, you're going to teach them how to apply. Now, my experience has been students in Mennonite schools will notoriously do the worst on concepts on a standardized test. Their percentile scoring, when you give an achievement test, tends to be lower there than it does on computation. We're big on computation. A lot of our 7th and 8th graders can out-compute most of the children their age across the nation. And in applications, I'm not quite sure if I have a handle on that, but I know just in comparing the little bit I know, and I haven't researched this, but the perception I have is that concepts we tend to be a little weak on. So as we go down through here, remember that this is something that I'm always bellyaching about to the elementary teachers. Saying, come on, you got to teach concepts. A student has to come out of your classroom not only being able to do the computation, but he needs to have, what's this about? What do these numbers mean? Where do they go? And so on. So just enlarging on these ideas a little bit, we'll go to the second slide I have here and develop these three areas a bit. We'll begin with math concepts. There's nothing big and flowery about this. Some of this is so simple that it seems to me strange that teachers oftentimes overlook it. Conceptually, vocabulary is the foundation of concept. Now that's broader than just mathematics. That's true in any area, any discipline of study that you want to talk about. The foundation of the concepts is the vocabulary. You cannot think about any subject unless you have words with which to think about it. Okay? I don't care if it's history or if it's math or if it's science or if it's what. When you think in words. Okay? And it's as true of mathematics as it is of literature class. It's the same thing. My point here is, for you first and second grade teachers, you've got to begin there to build the vocabulary, mathematical vocabulary, into the minds of students. They cannot think conceptually unless they have the word for it. Okay? And you can hardly ever get done talking about these words. What do they mean? What does it mean to add? What does it mean to subtract? What does it mean to divide? What is a square root? You know, and on and on and on and on and on. You can just advance from your lowest levels of mathematics to the highest levels. And if you don't know the vocabulary, you can't do it. And you can't even think about it. You can't conceptualize. So for that reason, I urge you to be sure that the students know the terminology of mathematics. So vocabulary is the foundation of concept. Quantity gives meaning to computation. Let me ask you a question. Can you, in your mind, visualize what it would be like to have 1 million rabbits in this room? Now, you probably have in your mind a squirming mass of brown and white tails and hopping around and fighting for their breath and all of that goes along with it. Well, let me ask you this. Do you think it would fill the entire room, top to bottom?
Absolutely.
Yeah, very likely would. Quantity, I didn't sit down and figure it out, but what would you have to do if you wanted to have a concept of that quantity? What would you do? You tell me. Yes. Okay, you might want to go with cubic inches, right? But you've got the idea. You're going to calculate cubic feet or cubic inches or something like that because you can better conceptualize a cubic foot or a cubic inch than you can 1 million rabbits. All right? And so what you would do is, and if you weren't sure, you might go out here and make yourself a little box, cubic foot, get some rabbits, go to town and buy them or something and stick them in that box and find out how many rabbits you could get in 1 cubic foot. And once you had that figured out, then you calculate the cubic feet in the room and then you would be able to give an idea of you'd have a better idea of what 1 million rabbits is. Okay? I remember a number of years ago when the United States first crossed the $1 trillion mark in debt. I stopped and said to myself, well, how much is that? And they had all kinds of ways of explaining it. Some people had dollar bills end to end going out in space somewhere and coming back, a few things like that. I ended up with a little calculation I thought was really neat. I thought, okay, take a building about the size of a church. Okay? and find out. What I did was I called down to the Bureau of Printing and Engraving and found out how many dollar bills it took to make a cubic foot. Okay. And proceeded to do these calculations for an average-sized church. I don't have the calculations in front of me here. I don't even remember the dimensions I used. But, you know, something like 100 feet by 40 or something. And 15 high. How many churches do you think it would take to hold $1 trillion stacked floor to ceiling, front to back, in an average-sized church? Well, try it for yourself. 300 churches. Okay. But do you see how that immediately gives you a better idea of what $1 trillion is than if I just throw a figure at you that, well, it doesn't really quite mean a whole. It's so big and so enormous, you don't have anything really to compare it to. But when I start talking about churches and cubic feet, now you've got at least something you can visualize in your mind. You've got a quantity that you can get a hold of. And then when you make this relationship from a number that's beyond you, it starts to make some sense. Okay? Now you notice here what I mean? Quantity gives meaning to computation. All right? This is pretty significant, even for the elementary teacher who is teaching that 6 plus 4 is 10. What do you do when you are teaching a student how to compute, even to learn the number facts? Are you teaching them to memorize a symbol, 6 and a 4, draw a line under it, and it's 10? What do you want them to be able to see and think and feel and even believe? Doesn't that sound religious? By the time you're finished teaching that number fact, see? Quantity gives meaning to it. So, for example, if I were to say to you, 60 plus 40 is equal to 100, I mean, what do you see in your head? What happens in your head when you see that? Do you kind of see a thermometer, 60, 40, 100, and kind of the relative positions of those two numbers? Or do you think on a piece of paper, 60 and 40, and you add 0 plus 0, and then 6 plus 4 is 10? There's a difference between the two. Okay, a fairly significant difference between the two. Now, obviously, when we get to computation here, we'll be talking about how you get it on a piece of paper. That's true. But the fact of the matter is, your better mathematicians have quantity in mind when they're thinking. Okay, and as a result, they don't get a stupid answer down on the piece of paper. Because if they're thinking quantity, they know that this should come out somewhere close to 100. Okay, if you're looking at 62 plus 48 and you end up with 296, I mean, conceptually that's wrong, right? It's way out. Okay, so you know you're wrong. The person who thinks that way in terms of quantity is able to give meaning to computation. And even to elementary teachers, I'm saying to you, pay attention to this. It may seem to you that all that is important is that student knows 6 plus 4 is 10, 5 plus 5 is 10. Now write down the list, and you can give them a piece of paper, and what they can do is they can scramble these things off in a minute or whatever time that you allot to them to get it done. It's more than that if you want to really develop a good mathematician. You want to attach to computation quantity. Quantity gives meaning to computation. Comparison validates quantity. I already spoke to that point. By the way, in mathematics, what do we call comparison? Well, it's a ratio, right? And actually, there are only three ways in which you can compare quantities. What are they? They are either, spit it out, somebody. Less than, greater than, or equal to. Okay? In fact, I'm always amazed at how very, very, very simple mathematics is. Sounds like a very complicated thing, but you can't do a whole lot with it. You know that? You can. We'll look here a little bit later on. Essentially, you can multiply and add, and you can compare. And that's about it. Now, they happen to be very, very powerful tools for problem solving, to be able to multiply and to add and to compare. I don't know if any of you have done computer programming. I have done just a tiny, tiny wee bit. Enough of it to know that that's basically all it is. Value comparisons. Greater than, equal to, less than. Okay, and on those kind of truth statements, you can build a whole computer program that will do absolutely amazing things, but that's all it does, is compares values and sees how they come out. So comparison validates quantity. Now, example that I began with is very clear on that. It's very clear on how you have to have something to compare it to. So the rabbits, the million rabbits, had to be compared to a cubic foot. Or the dollar bills had to be compared to churches or something of that nature. Number four, spatial perception adds spice to math, and I might say to life in general. This is three-dimensional geometry. Cubes and pyramids and spheres and all of that. When I tell students that when I went to school, I studied trigonometry for a whole year, they drop out of their chair and they say, "How could you study triangles for a whole year, pray tell?" Well, it's amazing what men can think up of about those things and talk about and things that I would have never dreamed of unless somebody had brought them up to me, I think. What did it do for me? Gave me a better spatial perception, three-dimensional. I'll never forget the first time that I was hit with a three-axis graph, you know, an X, Y, and Z. I'd worked with X and Y graphs for years and years and years, I thought, in school, and all of a sudden you're a 10th grader, and the teacher says, "All right, we're going to add an axis to this thing. We're going to put a Z in here instead of seeing just X and Y. Now we draw in Z. And give it that third dimension, that spatial dimension." And boy, that just kind of opened up the whole world. I mean, how many things do you do on a flat surface? Only flat. Most of life moves about in three dimensions, not just in two. And so I keep saying to students who are bogged down in this algebra one, I said, "Well, the reason you don't like this, you just haven't gone far enough. You got to keep going." You go far enough and you start to see the third dimension. And oh, by the way, now we add a fourth dimension, right? Time rearranges all the rules. Go ask our good friend Albert Einstein. What, you just thought you had learned it all. And you thought there probably was nothing else to be known about it. And all of a sudden, somebody pitches in this notion of relativity. For those of you who have studied mathematics that far, then you find out that when you add that fourth dimension of time, that was another whole ballpark that you have to start talking about. How does this fit? Just let me give you a little example. I think you'll be able to get a hold of this one. When you think of gravity, what do you think of? Do you think of a magnet? I mean, does it feel to you like the Earth is magnetically pulling you down to itself? Now then, I like to just stand and or lie down, just kind of feel it, you know, pulling you down. Do you think of the Earth as being some sphere somewhere, and anything that gets too close to its gravitational attraction, like a big enormous magnet, it's going to suck it into itself and it's going to you know pull it in? Is that what you think of? I do. Now, I just tell you, that's kind of the way I think about it. When I think of something in orbit, I think about something that's going fast enough so that the internal pulling or the strength of that gravitational magnetic pull inwardly is balanced by the centrifugal force moving outwardly. Okay, that's the way I think about it. Albert Einstein, when he added time warp to mathematics, thought of it differently. And this won't be hard for you to think about. Just consider this. Have you ever been to a science center somewhere where they have this cone-shaped structure and you roll a ball down on a thing and it goes round and round and round and round and round and then eventually kind of down the hole it goes. Okay? That was Einstein's conception of gravity. It was not the magnet and a thing swirling around it, but rather when you add time warp, or the fourth dimension, to it, now you see it very differently. You see something that's coming into the time warp of the Earth. As the Earth moves through space, through that continuum, it warps distance and time in such a fashion that it creates a little funnel like that. And so anything that gets too close starts in that vortex. Okay, and round and round and round it goes. And as long as it's going fast enough, it'll stay up. It won't go down the hole, right? It'll stay up there. But only if it loses too much speed, just like if something going around the Earth loses speed, bang, in it comes, okay? So if you shot that little marble down there and kept it going fast enough, it would stay right up in the vortex and it would never sink down into the black hole of gravity, see? Do you see how just shifting the dimension gives you a totally different view of it? The first time I saw that, I said, well, Albert Einstein, I believe you're crazy. But anyway, I could see how it might work. it's an approach. So time rearranges all the rules. Now, in your first grade mathematics class, though, you talk about time, don't you? Now, don't you get a clock out? And you start teaching them time? Well, of course you do. Why is that in math class rather than in science class? Well, it maybe could be in science class, but I know we deal with numbers. Numbers quantify. Numbers compare. Numbers do all of these things. Numbers make sense of time for us. Okay? And so it's taught there. I'm here to tell you that even on the elementary level, all five of these ought to be paid attention to when you are teaching a student the concepts of mathematics. Okay? Pay attention to their vocabulary. Help them to be able to quantify. What is a gallon? What is a quart? Is a kilogram bigger or smaller than a pound? There's comparison, right? We arbitrarily have attached values to weight and volume and that type of thing, but we do that so that we can compare. And you do a child a favor when you teach him young to be doing those comparisons and to think spatially, and also to remember that time is very important. The older we get, time goes by, right? Time rearranges the rules. Time is very, very, very important. Any questions or comments on math concepts? I'm going to come back and look at a few examples here in a few minutes on this. In fact, maybe I should do that. No, I'll move on through with the rest of this and then come back and show you on a test where you can easily pick out the person who was making the test was testing concepts, or they were testing computation or whatever. Math computation is the second category that we talked about, or that we have suggested, is very important here. As I already stated to you, really all you do is add and multiply. Now somebody's going to challenge me on that and say, well, don't you subtract and divide? Well, subtraction is only a derivative of addition. Okay, we try to make things as simple as we can, so we just tell the students all you're going to do is add and multiply. That's it. All year, you're just going to add and multiply. just to explain a little bit further, for example, any subtraction problem can easily be made into an addition problem, right? Okay, and so if you ask a philosopher of mathematics, he's going to tell you that all we do is add and multiply. Because when you subtract, all you do is add a negative number, that's all, instead of a positive number. All right? At the same time, when you multiply, when you divide, what are you doing? You're just finding out how many times that number up there on top, whatever it's called, is multiplied times that number outside the little thing. Do you see what my problem is? I'm only trying to emphasize something. If we don't know the vocabulary, we're in trouble, right? Okay, you kind of have to know what a quotient is. and you kind of have to know what a divisor is, and you kind of have to know what a dividend is, and your students have to know it, or you can't talk intelligently about it, and they can't think very well about it, okay? But what? All you really need, all you're really trying to find out when you divide is how many times you're going to take that divisor times the quotient to get the dividend, right? Isn't it a multiplication problem? Just goes right around that way. So all you really do is add and multiply. It's nice for students to know it's that simple, right? It's the beginning of the year. All we're going to do is add and multiply. As far as computation. Now, second thing here, when it comes down to math computation, is you need to know the functional symbols. I think you know the symbol for subtraction. I don't have them up here. I'm assuming that as teachers, you know them. And division and multiplication. But how many different ways can you show division? Somebody tell me. Yeah, give me one way. Yes. All right, you could show it as a fraction. 1 over 2 is 1 divided by 2. I am amazed at the number of high schoolers who never have kind of been exposed to the idea that a fraction is not much more than a division problem, or it can easily be shown as a division problem. 3 over 8 is 3 divided by 8. Okay? How else could you do it? Symbolically, now I'm thinking. All right? He's back here symbolically doing it, drawing a little slash like this and a dot above and a dot below. Okay? That's a division symbol. What else? Yes. All right, just the standard old half, what do you call that thing? I had, you know, looks like this. There is a name for it. What's the name for that? Can anybody help us out with the vocabulary? What do you call that thing? All right, you got an assignment. I don't know either. Go look. There is a name for it. Okay, so you can use that with your divisor quotient dividend system. Okay, what else? How else can you do it? All right, you have that 8 slash 2, 8 divided by 2, and you use that in computers, right? If you're gonna, they don't have any of those other symbols on there, at least the ones I've run, they don't. But if you put that little slash in there, it'll divide for you. Okay? Can you think of any others? All right, in a sense, when you get the little root system deal going, okay, there you've got something that tells you you want to divide this into equal numbers, equal quantities, so many of whatever they are, whatever the root tells you. Okay, can you think of any others? I didn't think of this ahead of time, so I didn't look at any books. What about multiplication? Tell me, how do you symbolize this? Yes. Just a simple little X, right? Okay, that's the one you grew up with. What else? A dot raised above the line. What else? Parentheses with the number right beside each other, with no symbol at all in between them. Okay? What else? In computers, it's an asterisk. Okay? Well, most of the time it is. Those things. I have a little notation over there. Somebody, I think Brandon Mullet sent it to me via email across the Great Swamp down here, as we call it. We live just 100 yards apart, but anyway, when he has something important to say, he emails me. And he has one on there about computers and females. You'd find it very interesting. I'll give it to you. One of the things, how are you supposed to know whether you're supposed to use an asterisk? How's this? You know, they have their ways of thinking. Okay? Any others that you could think of? Two variables, A, B, means multiply A times B. Right. Okay, you've got the idea. Now, the point is, if you don't know the symbols, you can't get anywhere. I mean, you can look at a page full of mathematics, and if you don't know the functional symbols, you're done for. Students should learn them. Okay? Is there a growing up In fact, most of your books that deal with higher levels of mathematics, like calculus and so forth, will have a whole page at the front of the book or the back of the book with just a listing of the symbols that are used by this book for a particular function. Okay? And there's a lot of them. When you really get into it, there's a lot of symbols that you have to know to be able to operate on that level. Math computation, you're not going to get around this one. Memorization and conceptualization, it's an absolute must. It almost goes without speaking. Don't think. I mean, you can maybe make this kind of fun. You can use all of your wit and charm to get students to memorize their number facts. But the fact of the matter is, it's just kind of brute hard work, isn't it? Just kind of knuckle down and do it. Let's just repeat and repeat and do it in a different way. Have as much fun at it while you're doing it. But the fact of the matter is, it's going to be hard work. They're not going to like it too much. And you're going to have to go over it and over it and over it and over it. And still some don't do all that well. I put conceptualization on there just to, again, emphasize to you elementary teachers, don't fail to get them to be thinking in terms of concepts, even while they're memorizing. You can give them a test. It's 100, say a sixth grader, 156 plus 310. They're to give an estimated value very fast. Okay, without even adding any numbers. I've always just simply bang, bang. You know, it's close to this. You can say, I want it within 100 or whatever, you know. And they learn more than to conceptualize than they would otherwise. And fourth, practice. After it's all said and done, practice some more. Just practice. Somebody's going to raise a question. If they don't raise it, if I don't raise it myself now, they'll raise it later. What about calculators in schools? Well, my first comment on that is this. Barring some drastic change, the calculator is here to stay. And you might as well come to terms with that fact. My second point is, on that issue, I wouldn't want to see calculators being used very much anyway, in first and second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth grade, until they really got a hold of the actual computations, the memorization of the information, and so on. But I have come to believe that I used to didn't even let the high school students use calculators. It's probably just sour grapes. You know, when I was in school, we didn't have them. Well, they had them. They were just coming out. There's a little LCD display, not LCD, the little lighted window job, and they were pretty expensive. And, you know, nobody in school had a little calculator that you used when I went to school. So, of course, I was sure that nobody else would use them either. However, so much surrounds that, and those surrounds little calculators and computers today. And even those little calculators, mind you, if you really learn how to run them, they are very, very powerful little tools, and you can buy them for $15. Okay, and they'll do an amazing number of things. So I'm just going to say that be careful with this, but for computations, I would much rather go into a chemistry class, 11th and 12th grade chemistry class, with the students having calculators and do 15 problems that day, than to go in there without calculators and they're going to get an opportunity to do two. Because by the time they work their way through all of them, through all the calculations that would be, some of them would be impossible, I can tell you that. You couldn't do them. How do you raise 1.00555 to the 20th power? Well, you do it by hand sometime and see how long you're going to be at it. but you could do it with a calculator very rapidly, okay? So my point is, we should be diehards on this. If the thing's going to be useful in the classroom to move the thing along, help the student to really get at the information, all right. Now, if I give an eighth grader 20 addition problems to do, I don't want any calculator in that thing. It's not the intention to see if they can punch the right numbers. The intention is to see if, in fact, they can actually add those numbers up and come up with the right answer. They can do the computation. But if I'm in physics class, and the whole idea here is to teach some concept about, you know, the curved trajectory of an object that is thrown or something like that, well, that's the aim, and the aim is not computation. So I'm going to say, get your calculator out and figure this thing out, okay? Because we're not here trying to compute so much as we are trying to figure out what the details are behind it. I'll give you a chance to ask further questions about that later. Applications or problem solving? We like to have things in our hands that are useful. The bridge between concepts and computation in nature is... math application is the bridge between concepts, computation, and nature. What the world is actually about. Now look at this little equation that I have written up here. Let me ask you. Don't feel embarrassed about this at all. I know that some of you, this is very elementary. For some of you, may not be. How many of you recognize it? Put your hand up. What is that thing? Okay, I see one person or so. Two, three. Okay, a few people just kind of wagging around here a little bit when they see that. Demonstrates a couple of points that I have already made. The symbolization probably to you is, what's it about? Okay, if I told you what the symbols are, I mean, you probably recognize the equal sign, showing an equivalency. You probably recognize that the T with that little 2 up there, called an exponent, right? We keep working on terminology and vocabulary. Or you might even tell the students that this is a superscript. Okay, something like that. What's that mean? Multiply the T times itself, right? Okay. What does the 16 stand for? Well, you know it. 16 is 16. What does a D stand for? All right. Well, what is it? Anyway. All right, you can use this equation to calculate how far an object will fall in a given time. Okay, so if you go to the top of a silo and you drop a ball, okay, and it's going to take so much time for it to get down and hit the ground. Of course, it's picking up speed all along, right? It's an acceleration problem because it's going faster the second than it was the first second. So you have an equation like this. That now you have a mathematical statement that makes a connection between a falling ball and time and distance and yourself. You've got something to work with. So if you were just interested in how fast you might be going if you jumped off of a 100-story building before you hit the ground, you'd actually have time, I think, if you use this to calculate how fast you're going before you hit. Especially if you had the calculator. of course, the first grader is not dealing with this. And if you even suggested it to him, it still would make no sense, right? But as that student moves through life, what's happening? If you help him to mature in his mathematical vocabulary and how to quantify and how to compare, how to compute, all of these things, now he is able to solve problems. He's able to make a connection in his world, and it often is made mathematically. Okay, so I take, when I was teaching high school, one of the local farmers there had a silo, and we had a lot of fun doing this. Not jumping off, but going out there and have somebody go up the silo, and I have them stop at a particular point. Nobody knew how high they were. Now, obviously, if you knew it was a 60-foot silo, you could do one of those quantifying things, right? It's about up there, about 30 feet or whatever, you know. And then have them devise an experiment where they could drop something and accurately calculate the amount of time that it took for it to hit the ground and then inversely calculate how far they actually were up there, right? Okay. So if you didn't know how far a well was down, you know, you can't see it, drop a stone. Check your watch, slap. Listen, remember that sound travels about 1,100 feet per second? Okay, do some calculations. You come pretty close to how far the water's down, right, with this equation. So what you're doing is you're putting into the hands of a person, when you teach them mathematics, tools to solve problems. Okay? And when you get to that particular place, then the student feels like he's getting somewhere. He's got something in his hands now he can use to solve problems. In fact, you can describe almost any natural phenomena mathematically. You know, from a ball that is thrown and the trajectory it takes to a person jumping and coming back down. I mean, it's all kind of, you can apply a mathematical statement to it. Now, of course, on a more practical level, 7th and 8th graders, we're not talking about d is equal to 16t squared, probably. You might be, but more than likely you're working on perhaps consumer math or something like that, where the student is really learning. Hey, take some time to do this. Even though I'm not big on savings accounts or things like that, it is very interesting to show to a student what will happen if he put $1,000 in the bank when he is in first grade. Okay, $1,000, and he refuses to touch it. If he can get it into some kind of an account that he can get 6% interest, let's say, and just let it there. He's got to let it there until he's 40 years old. Again, I didn't do the calculation this morning, but it always almost knocks your socks off when you see that number. I mean, it's like what parent who has his head on halfway straight wouldn't just put $1,000 in some account somewhere, just let it there. So that when his child is 50 years old, he can go pull that out of that account, and I can tell you it's going to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars in amount. It goes up phenomenally in 40 and 50 years if it's compounded daily and all of that. Okay? What are you doing to a student when you show them that? I hope not making them materialistic. But what you are trying to help them to see, something about quantity and value. In fact, I didn't put this one up here in math concepts. But we use numbers to apply value to something. In fact, I do this all the time. I say, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, how do you feel about this? 1 being the worst and 10 being you feel the best about it. Okay, so you kind of use numbers. Okay. So you want to take the time out in math application to help a student to get a hold of value and quantity. And then finally, variety and repetition. And I have this in here because when you are teaching sixth grade math, problems, reading problems, are things that students stumble over. The rule I would give, a little distance each day goes further than the same distance in 1 hour. The point here is, don't try to give them reading problems all in one day. Give them one or two every day. One or two every day using repetition and variety. Go back to something you did earlier. Give them a problem. Much, much better 10 minutes per day working on reading problems than to take a whole day and work on them. I want to say a whole day, I mean a whole period. And just do that little by little, little by little, day after day, day after day. There aren't a whole lot of shortcuts here. You'll find some methods in books that tell you how to find keywords and so on, so they know what to do there. That's all good. But for a student to get really good at it and to begin to conceptualize it, day after day, a little bit, not too much to drive them out the door, but just enough to keep them awake and alert and learning in all of this. All right, any questions on what we've discussed so far? All right, hold them until later, maybe. Maybe you can just kind of write them down. And now what I would like to do, we'll cut off here about, I'll go another 15 or 20 minutes maybe, looking at a few things and just showing you from elementary. I've chosen three different different levels here. This comes from an achievement test. I think it goes without saying that you do not lightly copy achievement test. It's the reason I didn't hand you out anything. I've got it up here. And so when I get finished with this, I tear it up and throw it away. Typically something that is used to instruct teachers. They don't mind at all, but you don't want to go, you know, just photocopying things for the fun of it. Okay. First thing I have here, this is an achievement test on mathematics concepts given to, I believe, this might be second graders. It's either first or second graders. This is what it is. And these are the kind of questions that go along with it. Be thinking now, vocabulary, quantity, comparison, spatial perception, and time when you're thinking of mathematics concepts. So the first question here is what you're supposed to do. Look at the figures in row one. Fill in the circle under the triangle. So the student looks at it, and what's that student supposed to know? Vocabulary, triangle. What is it? Okay. And not only that, he looks on the piece of paper, and he looks for three sides. This is a first grader, second grader. Okay. Number two, look at the pictures of the animals in row two. Which animal might weigh about 5 pounds? You see what the tester is doing? Wants to know something about quantity. So you look at the cat and the peep, is what that is, if you can't tell from where you're at. Let me get a little higher here. And the bee and the horse. Question, which animal might weigh about 5 pounds? Okay, and so, you know, the intelligent little second grader looks there and says, bee. Nah. But if they don't have an idea of what 5 pounds is, how are they supposed to answer the question? They haven't felt it, maybe in their hands. For example, what would you do if a student asked you, how heavy is a milligram? What would you do? So they said, I'm looking at milligrams. Well, how heavy is it? What would you do? Well, let's make it easier. A gram. What would you do if somebody asked you, student said, well, how much is a gram? Say again? A paperclip would be an excellent one. That's what I normally, if I don't have anything else handy, I open up the drawer and yank out a paperclip and say, well, not about that heavy. Toss it up in the air a little bit. Okay, let's say they're around there somewhere, small paperclip. If it's a 7th and 8th grader, you might pull out a dropper, an eyedropper, 10 drops of water and say, about that much. It's about a gram. You know, in some way or another, you'd help them to understand it. Now, if they hit it on a test or somewhere else, at least have an idea, something to compare it with. So the test makers here are just wondering, how good did this second grade teacher do in helping the students know something about weight? See, what is it? The cat, right? Okay, look at the numerals in the next row. Fill in the circle under the name for 92. What are we checking? Symbols. Okay, do they know what 92 should look like? Symbolically. I mean, it's not a quantity, is it? You don't see 92 little rabbits hopping around there. You see the symbols for 92. Let me see. I look at number 9. In row 9, look at the 4 rows of dots. Chris had 12 pieces of candy. He ate 1/3 of his candy. Mark the row that best shows 1/3 of 12. I can't even figure that thing out. Okay, so what are we doing? Parts. We're still on quantity here. And so the student is, this is being read to the student, right? They're not looking at this. They look at their paper, and we're trying to show which one of these represents 1/3. Notice that it's not a pie divided up. It's, you know, there you've got 12 dots and 1/3 of them circled and so forth and so on all the way down through there. For the second grader, that might not be as easy as you think it ought to be. Okay, when he looks at that, he has a tough question to answer. Let me go to something here a little bit different. Get another slide up here. Value. Can't miss that one, can you? When you start looking at money like that, that has to be dealing with something valuable, I guess. All right, but let's just look at some of these questions. Number 13, the question is, look at the number sentence in the shaded box in row 13. Which numeral makes this sentence true? Fill in the circle under the numeral that makes a sentence true. Student looks at this. They've got to know the symbols of the ought to know what the parentheses are about. And so they're going to solve that problem. How about number 15? Remember, first and second grade teachers, what I'm wanting you to see here is be sure you're teaching your students concepts. I like to say this just in the case I get one of your students. Seventh grade, I want this done. Look at the figures in row 15. Which letter is in the square and the triangle, but not in the circle? Fill in the circle next to this letter. So they've got to know what a square is, they've got to know what a triangle is, they've got to know what a circle is, and they've got to be able to interpret the rest of that information. Let's see, what else could we do here? I think I might have one more that I wanted to look at. Of course, the achievement test typically gets progressively more difficult, right? So what are we looking at here? You could almost guess without knowing as soon as you see that gallon jug there at the top. Or is that what it is? Let's read the question. Look at the picture of the milk container in row 24 at the top of the page. The container holds 1 gallon. 1 quart has been poured out of the container. Fill the circle next to the numeral that tells how many quarts are left in the container. Now, actually, they could just almost visually guess at that one if they didn't know, couldn't they? By looking at the diagram. How about number 33? You cannot see that real well, but I think that that thing is... this section is shaded, and this section is shaded. Okay, just the top fourth, left-hand fourth, and the bottom right-hand fourth. What's the question? Number 33. Look at the shaded figure in row 33. Fill in the circle under the fraction that tells what part of the picture is shaded. Enough said about that. I hope you get a grip on what we mean by math concepts and what one would have to be teaching at that level to make it work. Let's look at another level where you would be teaching math concepts. This would be 7th and 8th grade level. And here's a typical math concept achievement test for a 7th and 8th grader. Look at number 22. How much of this figure is shaded? Is the question. You can read the questions up there. So you have the fractions. Now, wait a minute. Is this 7th and 8th grade? I forget what level it is, but yes, it is. The two pictures below show when Alfredo, number 24, started and finished his homework. Here we have time. How many minutes did it take him? And so they look at the clocks and they make the calculation. 28, which statement below is false? 5 nickels are worth more than 2 dimes. March is the 3rd month of the year. Things of that nature. Let's look at another one. I want to get to one that I can have you do, see if you know what you're doing. Still in math concepts. Look at number 30. About how much longer is segment A than line segment B? You know what would be an even better exercise if you had a student in class? Don't have a ruler there. And just ask them in centimeters about how much longer is line A than line B. That calls on them to visualize what a centimeter is. It calls on them to make a comparison, some kind of a judgment about that. All right, you need to do an awful lot of that if you really want to help a student to be a problem solver in the end rather than just being able to do computation. Lots of students love to do a test that's just nothing but addition, but they hate to do a test where they have to think on. Okay, 37. Which figure below is not a rectangle? Okay, a lot of students will stumble right to begin with because they look at number one, they say, that's not a rectangle. That's a square. However, somebody quickly give me the definition of a rectangle. Say again. All right. We've got a four-sided polygon. What if we said quadrilateral? That sound okay? We have a quadrilateral. That's a good definition. Person could make sense of it. Or we have a... I'll use his since that makes it work nice. Four-sided polygon, and he said square corners or right angles, right? Is a square also a rectangle? Does it fit the criteria? Yes. It's got four sides. And the sides do form right angles. So number four is our choice, right? Student has to think on that, doesn't he? When he looks at that thing, he has to think to himself, well, what is a rectangle? And when he sees that square, he sees one and four, the tester is doing a good job. He's really testing whether he knows what he's talking about on that rectangle. Okay? Conceptually, he does know what it is if he's able to answer number four. Now, of course, if I were taking the test and I didn't know the difference, I would say, well, I know four is not a rectangle. I'm not sure about number one, but four is not. We'll circle it. Okay? Let's take a look at another set. Okay. 57, which of the line segments in the figure below is a diameter? Can't do it if you don't know what a diameter is. Okay? Number 63, what is the perimeter of the figure below? Student sees the problem, raises his hand and says, what's a perimeter? Vocabulary problem, right? Forgot that just means the distance around the outside. And we could look at some of these others too, but for sake of time, we won't. All right? Put those away and pull out one last high school test that deals with the same kind of, this is concepts on the high school level. Number 30, what kind of polygon is the figure below? That's probably too small for you to see way back there in the back, so I'll read them for you. Number 30, what kind of polygon is the figure below? And then you're asked, parallelogram, pentagon, trapezoid, rectangle, hexagon. Which one is it? Trapezoid. Definition of a trapezoid is? Okay, she says the two sides are parallel, the other two are not. Right? Okay, that's right. Can only be one pair of sides parallel on a trapezoid. If there's two pairs, it's a parallelogram. Parallelogram is not a subset of a trapezoid. Okay? So, yeah, you would put there that that answer is C, trapezoid. Oh, look at 31. In the numeral system with a base other than 10, 3 plus 4 is equal to 12. Okay? What is the base of the system? All right, now if you're not familiar with different base numbers, different base systems, you're done for on this one, okay? What in the world are they talking about? What is it? Solve the problem. Okay, he says B, base 5, is that right? Okay, I didn't want you to answer. I wanted everybody to answer on that thing. He's sure he's right. Okay, how many of you don't know if he's right or wrong? Okay, why not? Because you're probably not familiar with other base systems. Okay, ours is base 10, right? Quick math lesson here. That means the ones column is ones, and the next place value is 10 times that. And the next place value is 10 times that, and the next place value is 10 times that. You're very familiar with that, right? If you're in base 5, ones, the first column is ones, the next column is 5 times ones, or fives. So now look at your problem again. So if you have got 3 plus 4 is equal, if these are all base 5, right? Then 3 is in 1's column, so it is 3. Okay, 4 is in the 1 column, so it's 4. Its numerical value is 7, base 10. Okay, but the 1 and the 2, the 2 is just in the 1's column, right? So it gives it 2. The 1 is in 5's column, not 10's, 5's. So 5 times 1 is 5. 5 plus 2 is 7. So 12 base 5 is equal to 7 base 10. Aha, you learned something in this class, didn't you? Okay. But look at all of the skills you've got to have by the time you're a 10th grader in taking this test. If you're to be able to make any sense of that problem at all, you've got to know the vocabulary. You've got to have some kind of a concept of place value and what it means and where it goes and all of that that goes along with it. Okay? See. Some of these are beneath your intellectual dignity, so I'm not going to ask them. 36. 8 inches is what fraction of 1 yard? We're still knocking away at quantities and comparisons, right? What is it? 8 inches is what fraction of 1 yard? It says B. The answer on B, if I can read it right here, is 1/4. Is it? I'll see you cut. E. You know, your hint right off the bat is 8 over 36 doesn't come out too handy, does it? You're putting 8 over 32, probably. Okay. Yeah, that and Z. None of the above. Doesn't belong there. Don't be embarrassed. I went through and made sure I knew these answers before I pitched these up here. Okay, concepts. This is what we're talking about. Okay, let's look at just a few more here. Okay, here's your typical Cartesian graph. It's not three-dimensional, it's two-dimensional. Okay, so the points, negative 2, negative 1, 2, 1, and 0, 5, are three vertices of a square. What are the coordinates of the fourth vertex? Now notice the level of vocabulary you've got to know in order to be able to do that problem. Notice in addition to that, the number of things you need to know about symbols. For example, that first negative 2, negative 1. Somebody tell me, what does it mean? When you see it in parentheses like that, negative 2, negative 1, it means the negative 2 finds itself where? On which axis? Okay, so that means, see X right there? There's X, there's Y. So this is the X line, this is a Y line. So that negative 2, negative 1, they already have got it there. You can see it right here. 1, 2 to the left. So it's a negative 2. But if you didn't know the symbols, knowing that the negative 2 is always the X, okay, in that thing, and the X coordinate, and that the negative 1 is always, or the second value is always the Y coordinate, you wouldn't know which way to go. Okay? So notice Y comes down below 0, right, to negative 1. So what if I gave you something like 4, 5? Just an announcement or so here. Tapes are available. Singing tapes, whatever you might be interested in. Here to my right, David Strubar takes care of that, and you'd be welcome to check with him about that. The meeting this evening at 7 o'clock is an explanation of the TAP program, and I think our plan is I'm going to talk for about 10 minutes about the vision for TAP, 10, 15 minutes, and then Brandon will share a little bit, and then I think a number of the people who have been in the TAP program are going to just share little blurbs of their experience. And so if you're interested in that, you can stop by here at 7 o'clock this evening. Okay, now what we want to do is just see, well, okay, what happens if you're going to teach a lesson? How do you apply all of this? Some of this, I think, is so practical and so obvious that it's kind of like take advantage of it. Number one, before I even put any outlines up here or anything, if you're a first-year teacher, a second-year teacher, a principal, or whatever, there are a lot of very, very, very well-written text, school text. I would spend the money to buy one that is done well. If you have a lot of experience, you can wean yourself off of them. That's true. If you don't have a lot of experience, some of these textbooks practically tell you what to do, step by step. I mean, do this, do this, do this, do this. By experienced teachers, and my experience has been it's typically pretty good. If you take what they suggest, cut out, you can't do it all normally, cut out things that seem to be relatively unimportant, and follow their directions, it works pretty well. Here's a Bob Jones text. This is lesson 47. It's the beginning of Unit 3. And this is for the teacher. This is not in the textbook now. It's not the teacher's in the student's text. But if I were teaching this, and I were just hardly knew what I was doing and was frightened that I was not going to get these students taught, I would take this page and I'd take a good look at it. And just look at how detailed it is. Examine the picture on page 78 and read pages 79. Discuss as desired. Perseverance is needed in the study of math. Students must practice computation exercises over and over again to develop the speed and accuracy that are their goals. The various topics are presented again and again at the different grade levels. Even though the students are in the fifth grade, there is still much to learn. If someone has had trouble with fractions in previous years, it does not mean, and so forth and so on. Gives you a little pre-test for Unit 3 that you're supposed to give. And then you have the students' names, and you check here what they've done. Gives you an idea of how well they're doing. Okay? So that kind of gets the thing started. I have here two books that are down in the CLR bookstore. And I guess that's been announced several times already. This is not a Faith Builders store down there, but there are Brandon Mullet and a few others have a store down there. And they have some really good books on the way down to the dorms. Here's a core knowledge sequence. And if you were teaching and you kind of wanted to know what's important and what's not important, I'm not going to be able to get through all the material this year, but I want to make sure the students know what they should know before they go to the next grade. Buy one of these books. Now, I'm not a salesman for CLR, but I'm just telling you it would help you if you didn't know what should come next or whatever. It lays it right out. It tells you. Let me see here. Science, wait till I find... Mathematics. Let's see. Here's fifth grade. Math. It's one page. Numbers and number sense. Read and write numbers and digits and words up to the billions. Recognize place value up to billions. That just goes right down through the list. And you could very easily take a book like this at the end of the year. Make your own test. And see if, in fact, they are able to do what is considered by the general expert on fifth grade level, what they should do. Use that. Use a book like this. Use your own textbook. It'll have a lot of information. And here's another one that's a little more detailed. What your sixth grader needs to know. This is a whole set of books, I think, up to eighth grade, I believe. And it actually gives things in here. It not only lists them what they should know, but it gives examples, stories, mathematical work that they should be able to do. You've got a number of pages. Here's proportion and percent, and it gives you problems. You could take a book like this and at the end of the year give them a test right out of it, and it would give you an idea. Now, of course, a good curriculum already has that all built right into it, is my point here. And if you follow that curriculum carefully and do what you're told to do and make sure that they're learning that information, well, that's better than just stumbling your way through as a first year teacher and wondering if you're doing anything right or wrong. I mean, just do follow the directions. Okay, so we read Unit 3, or we take a look at it at least. You know, that introductory page. Looks like I have something a little bit out of order here. Just give me a moment. This is the next page in the book. Goals for Unit 3. I have become more and more and more goal-oriented the longer I teach. Have it very clearly in mind what I want to get done. Here, this text has it done for you. Read them. I will be able to read and write common fractions. This is from the student text now. 2, I will be able to rename common fractions. 3, I will be able to find a common denominator for a set of common fractions. 4, I will be able to add or subtract common fractions and mixed numbers. 5, I will be able to multiply a common fraction or a mixed number by a whole number. I will learn the identity property. These 6 things. By the time I'm finished, that's what I want to know. As a teacher, you want to make sure that the student has met those objectives. You're getting ready to teach the class now, mind you. So you just looked at your goals. Here's your vocabulary in this particular text. And again, I'm not selling Bob Jones materials. I just went down and pulled something off the shelf and looked at it this morning. Words to remember. They already have it done for you. Denominator, numerator, proper, improper, rename, common denominator, and so on. There they are. Would you give these as a matching quiz? You know, here's the word and here's the definition. I probably would not. Now, I might. But I very likely would maybe just give it orally. Put a couple of fractions on the board, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, and I, that represent the various things here, and ask in letter J, which number represents a denominator? Number two, I would say something like this. Draw a pi diagram that shows what that denominator means. So if it's a 6, draw a pi, divide up into 6 pieces. That's what I want him to do, because that's what the denominator means, divide by 6. Get it into 6 pieces, okay? I would not make just a straight matching quiz unless I really wanted to check their verbal skills, okay? And maybe that be the case. But there's your vocabulary. Of course, I would make sure I knew what the words meant myself before I went to class to teach the students this particular lesson. So we do that little overview. We set our goals. We have our vocabulary in place, and we're kind of ready to walk into the next page of lesson number 47. I mean, you know how these people do it. They do it so neatly. Lesson 47, pages 78 to 81. You can just turn to the pages and do it. Here's the lesson. Or page 81 that they want us to cover. What are we going to do here? Lecture in this class? No, here's what I'm going to do with this lesson. I'm going to get my, had my teacher's book, I'm going to assume, like, act as if this were my teacher's book. I'm going to go down through here. I'm going to look at these questions and ask myself, okay, what words may they not understand? What concept might they be short on that I'm going to have to explain? Is there anything computationally in here? You got this now? See? Concept, computation, application. Is there anything computationally that they will not be able to do? And then, of course, as an application, I might want to look at these down here to see how they're going to work out. This were my teacher's book now. I might look on here and say, okay, now we're going to go over these. Oh, that thing doesn't write for nothing. Might underline this in my book, because I've got to get there. I want them to do this work. I would say that in elementary class, without ever having taught there, but my guess is they should be busy with their own pencil and paper probably 80% of the time, 70% of the time, a very high percentage, I would think. Even as they move up through, don't do for the student what they can do for themselves. Okay, keep them busy. Practice. But I'm going to check this first of all. Vocabulary, I'm going to talk about that. Give an example of each. I've already gone over these terms, but I might think to myself again, okay, put a little mark in there. I want to ask them a second time. You know what a proper fraction is? Go through that a little bit. Make a drawing to show the following. So I think about that a little bit and think to myself, okay, maybe I ought to bring some. Yes? Sure. Okay. And I might think to myself, what do I have at home that I could just bring along and demonstrate this again? They're not going to draw now. I'm actually going to bring a little circular thing that I've made a couple of years ago that has little pie pieces cut out of plywood sticking down in there and show it to them visually so they can see it. and maybe ask them a couple of questions about how many pieces of pie are in here or whatever. I might just say to myself, okay, I want to use a visual here and think about what visual I'm going to use before I give this assignment so they've got an idea of what we're talking about. All right, a copy and complete. Now, this one's already completed because I copied this out of the teacher's manual. But like one of these, that would be missing in the student's text. And this is missing in the student's text. But I look there and I see that. It says 6/5 is equal to 1 1/5. And I think to myself, they might stumble on that thing. It's a possibility that might just get them. So I'm going to, again, just make a little mark there that I want to remember this thing. Here I see I see the various kinds that are there. You know your class, you know your students, and you're thinking to yourself, I better go over two or three of those before I give them the assignment. Or have John and Sally come up to the board and do them on the board to see if they know how to do them. In some way, I just want to review that a little bit before I give that assignment. I only want this to take but a minute or two, though. I don't want to take a lot of time. Because really what I want them to do is to get their pencil and paper and get to work. Okay? Number 5, do they know the symbols? Greater than is less than is equal to. Oh, that's right. Paul is forever getting these confused. Not sure which one is less than and which one is greater than. Let's see. What could I dream up just to kind of help him to understand that, it's wider to the left and you read sentences from left to right. You know, I might say to him, you read left to right, right? Yeah, okay. This is greater than that, isn't it? Yeah, okay. So, I work on that a little bit. But I'm trying to think through ahead of time before I come to the class. Now, if it wouldn't have been too embarrassing to some of the young children around here, I had a notion just to have a class. Just to bring some young children in here and have class. But I'm not going to get a chance to do that, I guess. All right, number 6, I look at it. Number 7, write an equation for each of these problems. And so I take a look at those problems and try to figure out if they're going to have a difficulty. And here we're back to making a drawing again to demonstrate these two. They might not have ever done this before, and so I might just put down here as a notation to myself. Okay, well, what I need is something like this and, this to help them understand what that's going to be about. Okay? Then I'm going to go to class that day. And the first thing I'm going to do is, if they had an assignment, work on that, ask if they have any questions, see about where they're at with what they were doing the day before. I'm going to introduce this lesson, and I'm going to tell them, for myself as a teacher, I have found this. Will most students read that goal thing? Are they going to read it? No. Are they going to listen to you read it? It might go in their ears, but I doubt they're going to listen to you. But I am going to stand up in front of the class, and I'm not going to read these 6 things that they're supposed to have for Unit 3. I'm just simply going to say to them, today what we want to do is we want to learn to read and to write common fractions. By the time you walk out of the door, that's what you're going to do. What that does is it helps them to know where you're going. Okay? And for me, if I've had 5 minutes to prepare for a biology class or any class, when I walk in, if I can just somehow summarize to the students, I really am summarizing to myself, I'm talking out loud, okay? This is what I want to get done today. That'll keep you from running down rabbit trails. It'll set your mind on what you want to get done in this class period. And you can just take right off with that thing and walk through it, okay? So we're not going to read those to them, but we are going to tell them. Today, I want you to be able to read and write common fractions by the time we're finished. I'm not sure how much of this has to be taped, or I would walk over here now and do this. And then I would immediately think to myself, okay, let's review fractions just a little bit. Put a fraction on the board. Talk about it. Ask him what that number above the line is, what its name is and what it means, the number below the line. Walk through all of that a little bit, making sure that we've established what they already know before we move on to what they don't know. And then, of course, talk about common fractions. And once we had got through those common fractions or whatever was necessary for today, then I'm going to say, okay, turn to page 81. I would not go through all the vocabulary either on page 80, on this particular page here. I would just have picked out the ones that I wanted to emphasize today and that they needed to know, talk about those a little bit, and then come to the lesson. While they're looking at page 81, I would be thinking about the explanations I wanted to make on this. And as soon as I had given a few explanations, I would say, okay, pencils out. I'd give them a trial run or so, not on here, but on a problem I had made up. Okay? One or two to see if there's a problem and if they can do them. And as soon as I had any kind of satisfaction that, they've got a pretty good idea of what's going on, I'd say, okay, get to work. Now, just to be real honest with you, most of the years I've been teaching, it's been run from one place to the other, and so about that time is when I collapse in my chair and start studying for the next class. You know, history class coming up or something after that. It's really a bad deal. What should you do? I mean, it's so obvious, but you tell me, what should you do? Just so I hear you say it, so I know that's, you know, you should do it too. Steve. Walk around and get your eye on that paper. And see what it is that they are actually putting on their paper. Okay? Of course, make sure they're working at it. They might be trying to do something else, you know, while you go up and collapse in your chair. In the end, it'll save you time, anyway, to go around and check to make sure all five or six students, or seven or eight, or how many ever students you have, are actually working on that page, and they do have an idea of what's going on. Sounds awfully simple, I know, but I can tell you that it actually works. You know, for those of you who are going in for the first year and you're a little worried, it actually works. Give them the vocabulary, give them a goal, have it firmly in your own mind. Start them working with some examples. Make sure they've got the skills to do what you're asking them to do. And just as soon as you can, not too soon, but as soon as you can, have them do it. Okay? And that may take different forms. If you have a class that is not too alert and you want to keep them alert, as soon as you teach it, say, okay, take out a piece of paper, number 1 through 10. All right, here we go. We'll see what you know. And for some reason or another, as soon as that word quiz comes, it's just like a shot of juice. I mean, they want to jump up. Oh, my goodness. You know, I got their papers out and they're ready to go. All of a sudden, they're alert. Okay? Well, do that. Do that. Again, the same principle applies. Lots of quizzes, short, to the point, over on a daily basis will get you further than your long test. Okay? It does a lot more. And that's about the way I would handle that. All right? Didn't talk about problem students in this little discussion. Didn't talk about the student who is way behind, or the student who is way ahead, or the student who can't somehow ever remember what to do when you have to carry a number or this or that. There are lots and lots of things that I would suggest to you that I think would be very good. Neatness. You can't overdo it. Nice straight columns. There's absolutely a necessity. consistency. Always do it the same way. Now, I say that a little carefully. I'm talking about elementary students especially. generally speaking, if you have a third grader who is having struggle with the concept, okay, having a struggle with the concepts, as we were talking about, but is able at least to do the actual computations, I would hammer on it. And I would always do it the same. Now, you know there's a couple different ways that you can do some problems, right? Now, I'm not talking about a reading problem. I'm talking about a computation way. Let me show you at least one of my pet peeves. Any problem with that? I do. What's wrong with that? What's a problem with it? Yes. All right. And I did not bring them over, and it's not only a problem with it's not only a problem of method. It's not even a true statement. Okay? See, I get too many students by the time they're in 7th and 8th grade when they put an equal sign, an equivalency sign somewhere. They want to do with that equivalency sign anything. Okay, those of you who have never had me for algebra have heard this 100 times. If you do something to one side of the equation, so help me, you better do the same thing to the other side of the equation. That's what that equal sign means. It's an equivalency. Okay. Now, do you see the connection between the elementary class where we're doing this and this algebra class where you really are wanting them to understand that is equals? Here, it's probably just a, maybe something that upsets me. I don't know, but I like accuracy. When I look at this, I say, well, it's not accurate. And furthermore, more mistakes are made. A lot of times you get this, right? I forgot that these even were over here. Didn't bring them along over, okay? When they did this equivalency. I like a paper that is not only consistently done, but that is mathematically accurate. It makes accurate statements about mathematics, okay? This is not an accurate statement about mathematics. That's just one example that we could give among many of what we mean when we talk about be consistent with method and be accurate mathematically. It is true, I know, that in many of our circles we do not have students who are going on to maybe studying Algebra 2 or advanced math or something like that, but it becomes increasingly critical as time goes along. And as you progress in those areas. Okay, maybe I'll stop for a few minutes before I go to the next lesson that I have, which is on a higher level. Do you have any questions or comments or helpful hints to give to the teacher who is going to be teaching somewhere in the elementary next year? Yes.
Do you require the student to always make so that you can see the way he worked the problem, or is it all right just to see the answer?
You got to see the way he did it. Actually, what I have found, at least, is if the students are working their problems out and you can see how they're doing a problem, and then you collect those papers, you can soon see where you're not sharp enough, where you haven't clarified a point clearly enough. It's where if you have two or three students making the same mistake and you can see it on the paper, you know what to correct. But if they just have the answers there, it's going to be harder to analyze that. Now, be reasonable in this, I think. I want enough on the paper that I can see how they did it. if you have a 10th grader, let's say, doing a physics question, it's not math. Well, yes, that is math. Math applied. I'm not saying they have to put everything there on that paper, but even if they're using their calculator, I want to see the numbers, and if they multiplied, added, subtracted, what did they do? And then the answer. It's my opinion. Okay, any other questions or comments? Steve. On the elementary level, I class in the schools where I was principal, I always like to see somewhere around 50 minutes. I know it's too long for a lot of schools that have their time jammed in.
Does that include the checking?
Well, I should be fair now. That'd be 50 minutes for probably two grades. How do we do it down there? Where are you at here, Joyce? Do you remember how long we took?
Elementary.
Okay. Okay. I couldn't quite remember how we did that, but yeah, so when I say 50 minutes, that's more like for two grades. Glendon, can't hear? Oh, sure. Well, up the sweat speed, drop the fan speed. Give you a little bit anyway. Is that okay? All right. Yeah, the question that was being raised there is how long should a typical elementary class period be? And, of course, it varies with the number of students and a number of other things like that. But we're suggesting half an hour, 35 minutes maybe per class if possible. Okay. Let's look at another lesson here. This is lesson 49. I'll not take too much time on this. I'll just kind of run through it very rapidly. Same grade level. Here. Pages 85 to 86, objectives are given. They even tell you the materials, text activity, written assignment. My point, inexperienced teachers, use your book. It'll help you. Here we are, choose the correct words. We've got a review on this right to begin with. Notice the emphasis on vocabulary. Got to know the terms. Down here is some practice with mixed numbers, improper fractions, lowest terms, and so on. And here's the final page of that day's lesson. We're adding fractions now. And if there's a problem, and it shows the student how to work this out, or the student's supposed to work it out, and so on. We go over that, we give the assignment, we get them to work. Okay, and we watch to see how they're doing. We may well, even if this is given as an assignment here, is there anything wrong with coming into class if you've taught those words the day before and pulling that up and say, okay, students, I'd like for you to turn to page 85. I'd like for you to do number one, A, B, C, and D. We went over the words yesterday. I want to see if you remember them. Go down through there and do them. You've got 5 minutes, or you've got 2 minutes, or you've got whatever. So they do them. You go over them. You decide whether you're going to take the grades or not. Maybe you just aren't going to take the grades. And so you go on. Okay? Variety and repetition. Okay? Let's look then at a higher level class and see once what we might be able to do with it. Yes, if I can figure out what I did. There we go. By the time I get finished, I'm very, very disorganized. I start out with everything in the right folder, right? Okay, this is 7th and 8th grade. And our lesson today, this is from Saxon Mathematics. How many of you are using Saxon in your high school? Okay, a few of you are. The Saxon course has probably the most consistently, and I didn't bring a text along here, it's probably the most consistently worked in the concepts, the ideas that I talked about this morning. It is not a Christian text, but you won't, there are hardly any pictures in it. So you won't find much, if anything, objectionable to the text And I would suggest when your school gets ready to make a curriculum change to take a look at the Saxon program. It's pretty good. It's one of the better ones that I've seen around. I wouldn't go just spending money next year on it if I had a good text that was already using. But on the other hand, if I was getting ready to make a text change, I would. Notice this. We remember from lesson 19 that a four-sided polygon is called a quadrilateral. Here we show several kinds of quadrilaterals. And we've got them: trapezium, trapezoid, parallelogram, parallelogram, rectangle, and so forth and so on. So the lesson kind of begins. A little bit of review. Today we want to classify quadrilaterals. On this level, we don't have nicely written out objectives that kind of spoon feeding us. We make ours. Okay? However, it seems very, very obvious when we look at it here, when we look at the lesson right to begin with. Classifying quadrilaterals. This is page 2 of the same lesson. So we begin our lesson by saying we want to talk about four-sided objects today. I might begin by having the students take out a piece of paper and say, I want you to write, draw four-sided objects. I don't care what they look like. Just draw. So they draw four-sided objects. We haven't even looked at these words yet. Okay? I might draw something like that just to see what they would say about it, asking if that's a quadrilateral. They might look at that thing a little bit. It actually is fairly easy to call it a quadrilateral if you're not on your toes, like I drawled it there for just a moment. but the other one that you can barely see because the thing's not writing very well, I just have a tiny little line there at the top. Okay? So it's 1, 2, 3, 4 sides. So the top of the pyramid has about a quarter of an inch long or so, okay? And try to get them to see, look, if it's got four sides, straight lines, it's a quadrilateral, okay? Quadrilateral. I might even pull that word apart a little bit. It's okay. Look at it. Quad what? Four, right? Start talking about something quad, that prefix is something to do with four. Lateral, something about lines. Quadrilateral, four lines. We enclose it. We've got a four-sided polygon. Might even stop and say, well, what's a polygon? Well, what would you say it is if I asked you? What is it? Closed figure with straight sides. Okay. Poly means what? Polydiagonal, polynomial, poly means many or more than one. Actually, if you're going to say polygon, you've got to have more than two, right? But yes. So if you say closed figure made up of lines, well, yes, it would. Yes, it would. However, you know that you can draw two straight lines on a globe, on a surface that is not flat, and still enclose an area. All right. That's how I remember of being in school, and all of a sudden, when we switched from Euclidean geometry to non-Euclidean geometry, the rules all change. You don't any longer have 180 degrees in every triangle. Okay, if you lay it out on a curved surface, it changes, and as you may expect, it changes with the degree of curvature, and all of that. So now you. Everything you learned went down the tube. The nice thing is, for most intents and purposes, we function with flat surfaces, right? For example, if you just take... Here's a good lesson on calculus. Listen carefully. If I went out here and constructed a building that was a mile long, and I did the construction perfectly, would the two... The north end of the building, the north wall of the building, and the south wall of the building be perfectly parallel? The answer is no. Because We measure this today. A line drawn from your point of reference to the center of the earth is a plumb line, right? So think of it. If you're 100 miles apart and you have two plumb lines going to the center of the earth, look how your walls sit in comparison to each other. They're not parallel. But do you see why, from a practical point of view, buildings aren't normally that big? And so we just say, well, we can just assume that the earth is flat, even though it actually has a curve to it. Okay? See, in calculus, that's all you really do is you run things to a, you run a problem to a degree where the curve or whatever makes no difference. Okay? You've got it where it doesn't count. For example, if you take a circle, right? And if you divide that circle enough times, pie pieces, right? The outer edge of that little pie piece is very, 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 very close to being a straight line. You understand? Now, if you have a big piece, sure, the curve is very clear. But if you have a very, very, very tiny piece, it looks up, it's approximating a straight line. Okay? And once you get it to that point, then you can count it as a straight line. Neat thing. That was a rabbit trail. Okay, trapeziums, trapezoids, parallelograms, rectangles, squares. So we work on them. Okay? Sample one, a square is a rectangle. True or false? I'd probably do these orally in class, these first few right here. And so this question is a good question. Student is supposed to, all of a sudden, huh, what is it? Is a square a rectangle? And if he's bright and looks back up there, he says, oh, well, let's see. A rectangle with all sides equal in length. Okay, that's a square, but a rectangle. A parallelogram with four right angles. So what's a parallelogram? Two pairs of parallel sides. Hey, yeah, square fits. Sure. A square is a rectangle. How about the next one? All rectangles are parallelograms. True or false? You answer. That's true. And you could, if students were unsure, what would you do? You'd go back to the definition. What is it? Do what you've got to get that down. Some squares are trapezoids. True or false? False. Why? Exactly one pair of parallel sides, not two, constitutes a trapezoid. That's right. That's false. Of course, there the answers are to it. Sketch a trapezoid in example two. Now we're going to get our hand to work. We want the students to do this. Get out a piece of paper. If you're really concerned about what they're going to know about it, have them cut one out with a pair of scissors. I mean, there's umpteen ways to kind of fasten it in their minds. This is what this thing is. Okay? Next page. We've got some practice coming up here. Answer true or false. And see, I'd take a look at my lesson and try to decide ahead of time. Yeah, I think I want to cover these orally in class. It'll cut down on their work and everybody will hear what's going on. Or I might say, okay, take out a piece of paper, A, B, C, D, and E. Get it down on your paper. Let's go. Now, A, all rectangles are squares, true or false? You don't have them answer that. And even take the grades if I thought it was the appropriate thing to do. Let's answer these. All rectangles are squares, true or false? False. They're not all rectangles, right? B, some parallelograms are rectangles. True. Some of them are. No trapezoid is a parallelogram. That's true, because we only can have one set. Sketch the following figures. Parallelogram that is not a rectangle. And so, what are they going to have to do? Draw it and make sure there is no right angle in it. Okay? Sketch a trapezoid. I want two sides parallel, and so on. Then we've got a problem set coming up. I look over these ahead of time, before class, and I think to myself, okay, any words there that they don't understand? Looks okay to me. Looks okay to me. I check out page 310, and I look this over. Okay. Here again, you see the strength of Saxon. Write each number in scientific notation. It has nothing to do with parallelograms, does it? Or quadrilaterals. What are they doing? One or two question review every day. going back and picking up on stuff that you maybe had 6 months ago or something like that. Write 2% as a fraction. I don't know what your experience has been. I've seen this over and over and over again. A seventh grader given that problem doesn't quite know what to do. Unless they just had it the week before. And even then, sometimes they don't. Okay? Review. Here's a book that does it almost all for you. It has the review written into it day after day. Okay, we've got 15 minutes left. Your questions. That I hope somebody can answer.
Do you think it's important to make the students work? I gather from what you said, you think it's important then to make the students work on what you just talked about?
Yeah.
I mean, like, I know when I was in school, maybe I had something that needed to be done yet that day, and I wanted to do that before you don't allow me.
No, I don't permit that. I tell them this is math class. And I gave you 15 minutes to work on this for a reason. The reason is I want to find out if you know how to do it. And there might be somebody who can do it very fast and get done. I tell them, look, if you're totally done, yeah, you work on something else. But work on this till it's done. I wouldn't insist that's the only way to live life in the classroom, but that's the way I do it. Okay? See, what you need to understand, of course you will have bright students where this would not be any problem at all. I mean, you could give it to them, they could work at whatever they're going to do, and they could get it done that night or another period or be fine. But it's not a very good classroom dynamic, I don't think, to have deliberately planned to introduce the lesson, to give the lesson, to practice the lesson, to give the assignment and have them start on it so that you can check on what's going on if that's not what you intend to do. I mean, if I laid that plan, that's what I try to follow through with. And I have just found it to be pretty useful. Another question there.
How do you answer a student who asks, why study algebra?
Ask those girls back here. I give them such a thorough lecture that they don't ask again. Oh, no. I didn't even talk about this today, but mathematics is a thought process, right? It's a problem solver. It sets your mind in order. You've got to think in an orderly fashion. I try, in my own feeble way, to demonstrate to them that they may never use the actual equation in life, but the organization that it brings to your head and the ability to think through a thing and solve a problem and have the tools to solve a problem is a way of life. It's an attitude. It's something that's down in your warp and woof that if you do it well mathematically, you tend then to transfer that to other areas of life. And as a result, I think the algebra lesson that is well taught is helpful in that whole process. However, I would not launch into, when I said I lecture them so badly, they don't ever want to hear it again. Don't take me too seriously on that. Students, in the end, they either trust you or they don't. Now, I don't mean honesty or anything like that. I mean, they trust you as a person. They see value in you as a person. They see strength in you as a person. And they will connect, you know, the vim and vigor that you bring to a classroom and your own, who you are yourself with the value of this. Almost unconsciously they will do that. Now, I don't want to put all the burden on the teacher, but I just think it's important for the teacher to know the subject well enough and be excited enough about it that they just kind of know that it's important. Poor answer there, but anyway.
When it comes to working with degrees and so on, they got to put it on paper. So many degrees for these lines.
Yes.
Do you work with exactness, or do you give like a 2 or 3 degree off?
Yes. I normally, in a typical assignment, gave an assignment, there are angles in the book to be measured. I'll tell them before the assignment, before they do the assignment, okay, it's plus or minus 1 degree or plus or minus 2 degrees, depending on what level of accuracy that I'm after on the thing. I measure them ahead of time to make sure that they are that close, because sometimes they can be a little bit off. I mean, you want to push on accuracy as hard as is reasonable, I think is my point. Mm-hmm. Or else I'll tell them, okay, these should all be rounded to the nearest 5 degrees or the nearest 10 degrees or whatever, and then they should all have the same answer. Because if they are 1 degree off, they're still going to have 75 degrees rather than 74 degrees. So I think it depends a little bit on the nature of the assignment, but I don't know what the rest of you do, but for me, I normally allow plus or minus 1 degree for sure as a margin of error. Anybody else have a comment on that? They're off a little bit. Yeah, they may be off a little bit. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Tim. Okay. That's very interesting. There you go. Just a piece of information to keep in mind. CLE is coming out with a text that is modeled after the Saxon text here that I was talking about. Good. You'll be thinking about retiring then. Okay, Harold. Teachers never retire. I don't know if you know that or not. Steve.
I'd like to respond to Michael's question.
Yes.
Last year, in addition, I had a general statement to answer students who asked why we study this. He said, do you know what you're going to be doing in 10 years? And usually the student doesn't know. So
it's a good question to ask.
That should help me think.
It's a good question to ask. Okay. In case you didn't hear there in the back, Steve was addressing the question of why should I study algebra. Ed Gish's typical answer is, do you know what you're going to be doing in 10 years or 15 years? And if the person says, no, I don't know, Ed says, well, that's answer enough. Okay. Other questions? Great. Let's leave out 5 minutes early. Is that okay with you? Let's stand for prayer. We'll dismiss you. Thanks, Father, for today and for the opportunity that we have had to think about these things. You are truly awesome. When we consider the great intricate details of the world in which we live in and the fundamental mathematical laws by which many, many things function. The earth seems to hang in space, but it's here by your good hand. Pray that you would dismiss us with your blessing and give us a good evening. Help us, Lord, to commit our lives to you. In Jesus' name, amen.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.